you sit in traffic now. But later, there's a nice cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, all your patience is paid out in gold. You remain calm through honks, bumper to bumper, and people yelling.
Come on, move!
You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Pitch. Swing and a long drive, deep left, way back, gone!
Welcome back to another episode of the 90th Percentile. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. Alongside me, as always, is my co-host, my partner in crime, my man out in Colorado. Different time zone, but we stay on the same circadian rhythm. Matt Pajak, how's it going, dude? How you been?
I've got like that with the way that the shadow's coming in right now. It's early here. It's 7:36 in the morning. With the way the shadow's coming in, it's got like that detective movie or detective show feel to it. Where it's like,
yeah,
hit the blinds. Most of my face is covered. I just had to get comfortable because this is going to be a long one, Jeff. This is going to be a long one. We got a lot to talk about here on the heels of the announcement last week that college baseball programs will be able to fund 34 full scholarships starting next fall, which is pretty significant considering that as of right now, 11.7 is the max amount of scholarships allowed across a college roster. So a lot of changes coming to college baseball all at once. There's a lot of different things that we want to get into, kind of how the game's evolving, how it impacts talent pool, how it impacts the pro game, a whole bunch of different things, exposure funnel probably sprinkled in there. But yeah, it's a doozy of a topic, Jeff. Doozy of a topic that we're talking about here.
I would agree with you. I would agree.
Yeah, I would hope that you would, Jeff. And I'm not holding you here against your will. yeah. So for the people that aren't aware, college baseball historically has had a 11.7 scholarships across their roster. Now in recent years, that has been supplemented by NIL collectives with bigger programs, which has already started to create some separation between programs that have money and NIL collectives and programs that don't have NIL collectives or money to throw towards the baseball program. But that's only going to get, I don't want to say worse, but that gap is going to get bigger as certain programs are allowed to go 34 full scholarships based on the resources of the athletic department, and other programs are just not going to be able to do that. Jeff, I think there's something that a lot of people don't understand in regards to college baseball, and that's, yeah, there are programs that are operating with 11.7 scholarships, and that doesn't seem like all that much. If you're a college baseball player and you are on a quarter athletic scholarship, that's pretty good. And that's been the case for the past couple of years. If you're on a quarter athletic scholarship or a half, I mean, a half is really good, but it's very rare that a college baseball player is on a full athletic scholarship, and we're about to enter a territory where you could have 34 on fulls as soon as next fall, which is going to happen at certain programs. But there are D1 programs out there, Jeff, that don't even use 11.7 because it's not in their budget. There's one of the Division I programs here in the state of Colorado. I was recently informed that they operate with four scholarships per calendar year, per academic year. So They're fielding a full baseball team with four full academic scholarships or four full athletic scholarships, even though they're allowed 11.7 just because the resources aren't there. So, Jeff, I think what this is going to do is this is going to potentially push some D1 programs out of Division I baseball, and it's going to create a clear-cut separation between the haves and the have-nots. I think you might see a little bit of like an FBS, FCS type deal in college baseball as well, which is a little bit unfortunate. You know, as someone who grew up really enjoying the college game, you know, you and I both grew up going to Cape Cod Baseball League games. You still go regularly because you still live up there. But, you know, some of my earliest memories of going to camps on Cape Cod were with players like Danny Espinoza, from Long Beach State, or, you know, you had players Cal State Fullerton. I remember, you know, watching Omaha finish up Fresno State, these types of programs in the past couple of years. You know, we've been, you know, pulling for the UC Irvines of the world, the ECUs, the DBUs, the mid-major programs that might not have the resources to get all the way to 34. They're going to be at a disadvantage because there's going to be SEC programs, and we're already starting to see it. We'll get into it here in a little bit. That are going to have the money to pull whatever talent they want, and that's going to be a separator in competition. I don't think you're going to see mid-majors make runs at Omaha. So I don't think you're going to see UC Santa Barbara and Long Beach State and Cal State Fullerton. I think that, you know, those are days long gone. It'll be interesting to see, you know, historical programs like UCLA, Arizona State, how they handle it, you know, but it's a different day in college baseball. It's a day that's going to be driven by money. And I'm not saying it's going to be bad, but it's going to be a stark departure from what we all have known for the past, you know, since I've been watching college baseball, since you've been watching college baseball. So that's the gist of this conversation. There's a lot of different kind of turnoffs and different things that we're going to talk about, you know, implications, how it impacts the pro game and all that. But Jeff, is there anything you want to, you know, kind of say before we get rolling into this?
No, I mean, I think that this is a topic where I'm just not as well versed when it comes to how the scholarships are handled and, you know, some of the changes, how certain teams utilize more scholarships than others. So I think for, you know, at least from my own personal experience and knowledge, I'm probably going to learn quite a bit from this podcast, just sort of asking questions throughout, that maybe some of our listeners might have, you know, a similar lack of knowledge and can gain from, you know, the amount of time you've spent studying this and, you know, of course, thinking about this podcast because it's been a couple weeks in the making.
Yeah, I think before we get going, the last thing I want to say here is just that I think change is important. I think change is necessary. I think my hesitancy with the changes that have occurred in college baseball, and this has impacted other college sports as well, but, you know, this is a baseball podcast, so we're going to talk about baseball, is how, like, significant the changes have been. We're not talking about like small changes here. I think if you jumped from 11.7 to 18 scholarships, I think that's a pretty sizable leap in terms of how a college baseball program would be making out their budget. Hey, can we get another almost 7 scholarships in here? That's a pretty sizable jump. But we're talking about going from 11.7 to 34. I mean, that's almost threefold, right? So there are programs that are going to be able to do that, no problem. And then there's programs that aren't even going to be able to think about that. And then there's a bunch of programs that are somewhere in the in-between that are like, okay, we're at 11.7 now. Can we get to 18? Can we get to 22? Can we get to 26? If we're, you know, one of two programs in our mid-major conference that can get to 24, that gives us a significant edge over everybody else because we know that program, you know, D, E, F, G, H can't do that. We know that they're not going to be able to increase their scholarships because we know that, you know, their academic programs or their athletic department isn't positioned to give more money to baseball. So 11.7 to 34 is a seismic change.
The transfer portal was a seismic change. You know, adding an extra year of eligibility for the COVID players, that was a seismic change. NIL being introduced to miss all of this in the past 2 or 3 years, seismic change. And you're talking about a lot of things that went from, yeah, the water is dripping and we've got a leaky faucet and we got to tighten that thing up, to like drinking out of the fire hose, trying to figure out what to do. And these things are, they're hit from different angles. It's not like it's okay, let's put all our focus on this one problem. It's like, okay, we got to figure out how to recruit college players and high school players at the same time. We got to figure out, you know, what college programs are we competing with? You know, do we have the money to compete against pro teams for players, which we're going to get into here in a second. But I think that's something that people just really need to understand, is that like, if the transfer portal became a thing and they said you can bring, you can have 3 or 4 players enter your program during a transfer window, like that's a change. And I think that's a good change, but it's unlimited. So now you're having, and we saw it last year with Wichita State, and we see it every year with at least 1 or 2 programs. Like, coach leaves, the entire roster, we saw with Campbell this year, the entire roster enters the portal. Right. And then it just becomes a matter of like, okay, new coach comes in. It's like, how many of the, now you've got to recruit your roster from last year back to the program and then potentially supplement with anybody guys, with anybody that left. You got to fill those guys in. It's like, what are we doing? Right. Like, that's what we're talking about here. It's not like, oh, you know, there's only 3 or 4 spots can be filled by each roster. So like, let's hang here, meet this new guy before we make a sit. Nope. I'll just leave. And they go into the portal. And I don't know. It's just, it's a very volatile time for the game. But I'm going to get into it here. My first point of emphasis that I want to get into here is talent hoarding. Because I think we've already seen this with NIL the past couple of years, and I think it's only going to continue to get worse. And it's not good for the game. Okay, so this isn't the only program that does this. There are multiple programs that do this, but this is a program that is well covered because it is basically the most important sports team in Baton Rouge. Anything to do with LSU sports is the most important thing in Baton Rouge, which is a decent-sized city down in Louisiana. So they cover it. They cover LSU baseball. They sell out Alex Box. So we have all of this information just publicly available, but they are one of the programs that's known to have NIL resources. And they're pulling players from historically good programs. Like Thatcher Hurd came from UCLA, Gage Jump came from UCLA. LSU has that kind of pull, and this year, they've already pulled in multiple players from the collegiate national team. Daniel Dickinson from Utah Valley, Anthony Ianson from UC San Diego, Chris Stanfield from Auburn, Cape Cod Baseball League player, and a number of other guys. I mean, they've got, I think, 16 incoming players on their roster with college experience that will be competing with their freshman class that includes players like Cade Aaron Beatty, William Schmidt, Derek Curiel, Mikey Ryan, David Hogg, Ryan Costello, John Pearson, Matt Rizzi, Landon Victorian, Kaysen Evans, right? So they got a sizable freshman class coming in. A lot of talented players. There was draft buzz around Aaron Beatty. William Schmidt, I think, is one of the more surprising ones that didn't go. Derek Curiel early on. These guys are now getting to campus alongside 16 new incoming players with college experience. And on the other, before any of this happened, 11 LSU underclassmen hopped in the portal and left after minimum involvement or underwhelming production during the 2024 season, right? So you had a freshman, Ryan Kucherak, with 12 at-bats, a freshman, MJ Seo, who did not play. You had a freshman, Nick Bronzini, who had a little over 4 innings pitched. You had a freshman, Cam Johnson, who probably could have took money from professional baseball and gone into pro ball last year. He saw 9 innings pitched for LSU this spring, completely healthy. Okay. redshirt freshman Zeb Rudell, who's tooled up. He had 10 at-bats. He just transferred to Louisiana Tech. You got freshman Austin Rolig, who did not play. You've got freshman Derek Mitchell, who did not play. And then you've got a couple of sophomores who had less than 20 innings pitched. I mean, Jeff, what you're talking about here is a roster full of highly touted high school names, got to campus, didn't play, hopped in the portal. So now you're sitting here and you're looking at a very talented incoming class that's going to be competing with a bunch of players with college experience. If you haven't listened to previous podcasts, go back and listen to previous podcasts. We talk about age and experience beats out your talented freshmen. Okay. Which of these players, Jeff, isn't going to play and then it's going to hop in the portal? Because it's going to be 5, 6, 7 of them. Cade Aaron Beatty, William Schmidt, Derek Curry, and Mikey Ryan. I gave the names earlier. Which of those guys is going to be looking for a new home? Okay. So that's ultimately what I'm talking about here when I'm talking about talent hoarding is, okay, really talented players coming to LSU, competing against older, more experienced players, not going to play. Cycle is going to repeat itself. They're going to end up in the portal, and they're going to lose a year of playing college baseball. And more importantly, development as a player by not playing at LSU. So again, LSU is not the only program that's situated to do this. There's other programs that are situated to do it. It's just, it's not healthy for the sport.
Yeah, and I think that's – I see it all the time. You know, I actually saw a few of those guys that you mentioned that were LSU guys that didn't really play that were on the Cape. And they get – it's good for Cape coaches, especially if they're pitchers, because they have a whole lot of innings to make up. The flip side of that is if they end up in the portal, they may make up some innings, they may perform, they commit somewhere else, and then their new college coach is like, get them off the mound. We don't want to waste any more of these innings or get this guy hurt in the Cape Cod League. So, you know, it's made in a lot of ways the Cape sort of like a showcase in the summer, which has got its drawbacks and I guess its positives as well. But it's different than it used to be where you're not seeing as like many established guys. And, you know, you have to wonder how much this hurts kids' earning powers too. You know, they commit to a school like LSU, which is obviously a big deal. You want to commit to the best school you can out of high school. You want to try to compete for a national championship, especially if you're a competitor. And then, you know, sometimes it's just a bad situation where you're not going to necessarily get the innings that you need to develop and or the at-bats that you need to develop. I mean, we saw it with, you know, a player that we had on this show a couple seasons ago, Garrett Martin. You know, who's a guy that went to a few different schools, did the JUCO route, got his at-bats, then committed to, I believe it was Oklahoma State, was there for whatever a year and didn't really play. What do you see, 20 at-bats or something like that? And then, you know, ends up an older player at Austin Peay where he's very successful. You have to wonder if he's at Austin Peay as like a junior instead of going to Oklahoma State, gets those at-bats, like how different is his bonus? How different is his earning power coming into pro baseball? And I think, you know, that's the first real payday for these guys until they make it to MLB. So the difference between signing for say $100,000 and $350,000 is pretty big, especially when you're making $30,000 a year, maybe in the minor leagues. And, you know, you got a bunch of different expenses you got to pick up. You got to get an apartment. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to pay for food, not all of it, but a lot of it, et cetera. So, I think it has an impact even on how much these guys can train and the sort of debt they may have to put themselves into.
Yeah. And we'll get into some of that here in a second. I do want to talk about, you know, NIL collective versus an MLB draft pool and an inefficient market overlapping with an efficient market, which we'll talk about in the context of world soccer. You can even talk about it in the context of world golf as well, but on a much smaller level. That's potentially what you're going to be looking at here is, you know, NIL collectives being able to pony up more dollars than MLB organizations who are, you know, hyper efficient in their valuations of players. They're not going to overpay for high school or college talent if they're getting outbid by NIL collectives, and how that potentially hurts the talent pool. We'll get into that in a second. But I mean, the bottom line is, Jeff, is that there's 9 positions on a baseball field, and there's 1 Friday night guy, 1 Saturday night guy, 1 Sunday night guy, and then like 1 midweek starter. So like if LSU's bringing in 9 outfielders and 4 or 5 of them have college experience and 3 or 4 of them are, you know, pedigreed high school players, like there's 3 outfield spots and the guy who's good enough is going to get the regular at bats and the other guys aren't going to play. I think what, you know, kind of close the book on the talent hoarding thing. I mean, look, if you can go to LSU on a full ride as the 34th player on the roster, or you can go somewhere else on a quarter scholarship, I mean, Jeff, why wouldn't you go to LSU on a full ride versus going somewhere else on a quarter? I mean, they're going to tell you everything. You're going to have every opportunity to earn playing time. You're going to have every opportunity to play here, this, that, whatever. But yeah, I mean, you're going to take the full scholarship at LSU over taking a quarter scholarship at a mid-major, even if the quarter scholarship in the mid-major, you know, gets you a much clearer path to playing time. I think that's kind of the thing that makes me scratch my head, and I'm not really sure, you know, how that's all going to shake out, but that's going to be a problem. Because again, it's not like LSU can field 2 teams. The other thing that, you know, and Pierce brought this up, he said he was talking to a college coach, and I don't even want to call it the Power 5 anymore. I guess we'll call it the Power 4. A Power 4 college baseball coach was saying that with the new, and it's another rule, if you're keeping track at home, write this one down. There's 34 roster spots year-round as of the fall of 2025. So right now, I mean, and I heard it from my buddy who's in pro ball. They took an Instructs team up to play Arkansas last fall, and there were over 70 players on the fall roster for Arkansas. And obviously that's not what it was when they went into the spring. So, you know, 25 plus players got cut. Well, you can't do that anymore starting next year. It's 34 year round. That's the cap. So, Power 4 college baseball coach says we need to account for 4 players getting hurt, because that's hurt players count against that 34. And I need 30 players at all times that can contribute. So there's no room on that roster for a raw developing talent. This guy's toolsy. He needs some time. There isn't going to be room for that. Guy 1 through 30, according to this power four coach, is going to need to be able to contribute because now they're accounting for injuries. So it's further going to accelerate this idea that the toolsy high school player is going to have to go find somewhere else to play because it's not going to be in the Power Four. You're going to have to go play in the minor leagues of college baseball to get the opportunity to go play in the Power Four. If you go to the Power Four straight out of high school, I mean, you're asking to sit the bench basically, because you're just going to be competing against a bunch of 21, 22 year olds that have track records of hitting 370 at Wright State, or, you know, 390 at Fordham, or, you know, just pitched a full season at, I don't know, you name it, UC Irvine, Tulane, Xavier, right? Just pitched a full season at Xavier, hopped in the portal, and now you're pitching in the Power Four. Anyway, NIL collectives versus MLB draft pools. Jeff, there was a couple notable situations in this draft. We can speak publicly on Ryan Prager, because Ryan Prager announced he was going back to Texas A&M and he was turning down third round money. Slot at the pick that he was chosen was right around $950K, so roughly $1 million he turned down from the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim to return to Texas A&M. I've heard anywhere between half of $1 million and to $1 million is what he will be paid by the NIL collective at Texas A&M to return for one more year. So you sit there and Jeff, that's a lot of money for 1 year of college baseball, somewhere in the, you know, $600,000-$800K for 1 year of college baseball range. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, this is, we're kind of entering into, I don't want to say unprecedented territory, but he's not the only one who had decisions to make in regards to NIL money versus draft pool money.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a few things going on here. I think it speaks to the dwindling opportunities for, you know, the guys that end up at a Power Five school that don't necessarily play as freshmen or maybe much as sophomores that develop in that program and then get their opportunities in their draft spring as juniors or may even come as a sophomore. But development at Power Five conferences is pretty much non-existent at this point. The guys that have to develop, they're going to end up transferring out, as we've kind of laid out. They're not going to necessarily stay at those schools. If they are, they're running the risk of maybe never earning full-time playing time until they're maybe 22 years old. And at that point, it's dwindling returns on what their pro career is. You know, I think that paying players NIL in practice isn't necessarily the same as what it is in terms of how we viewed it before it existed in terms of like theory, right? And I think that's the biggest concern is, yeah, players are getting paid and that's good. It's good that they're, you know, being compensated for their name and image and likeness, and they have an opportunity to, you know, have a little money in their pocket. But I think by the same token, it's maybe gone a little bit too far. The numbers have gotten so extreme. Baseball is a very small piece of that pie. I think if you look at some of the numbers tossed around in football, it's outrageous. And it's just, it's changed the way that the college game operates. And they're not, they haven't been able to find sort of a balance between amateur status and professional status. It seems like it just went from full amateur to full professional, and they haven't been able to find a balance. And, you know, there's a lot of great athletes that are out there that aren't in, you know, we'll say the big four sort of sports, being, you know, hockey, yeah, to an extent, but probably more so football, basketball, baseball. You could maybe throw like women's softball or something like that in there as the fourth that probably get more NIL money than hockey. But I think the other side of it is, you know, you're seeing players that can get bought out of the draft and not just good high school players, right? Guys like Prager, who, when you're buying a third rounder, even if it's, I don't know what the number is, but let's say it's $500,000 and he can go back into the draft next year and pitch and maybe get a Brandon Sproat sort of deal where he moves up around in the second round if he pitches well enough and gets $1 million, it makes a lot more financial sense to that guy. But I guess my question is there a sophomore out there at Texas A&M? This is a hypothetical, so you can yell names at me, Texas A&M fans, that might have gotten an opportunity to start next year, or an incoming junior that maybe doesn't get that opportunity in the rotation to maybe go as a ninth round pick or something like that, or maybe even higher. Like, it's just, it pushes everything down. And the other part of it too is the draft date being where it is can lull people into a false sense of security in terms of opportunities within a rotation for a pitcher, because there's so few of those jobs, right? I think everyday players, you know, position players, guys can get hurt. They can find a job. It certainly can happen with pitchers as well. But Prager coming back changes the situation for at least a few of those pitchers that might have been competing for a rotation spot coming in. And them knowing that in late July to August 1st is very different than if they knew that in June or they knew that July 1st. Then they can make a decision to go into the portal, look for other opportunities, go to a school where they know there is going to be an opportunity for them to pitch, even if it's not in the SEC. It might be in the Big Ten. It might be in the Big 12. It might be in the American Conference, you know, pitching at Elon or whatever. Right. I think that's sort of what my concern is it's making college baseball older and it doesn't necessarily need to be. There has to be some balance here. And the fact that some of these schools can now hoard players and they don't even have to force them off because they can give them full-time scholarships just muddies the waters even more. And, you know, it's going to make the rich richer. And, you know, I think our hope was with the transfer portal rules coming out of the pandemic in 2021 and beyond, was that some mid majors would maybe end up with some more talented transfers than they would. And I think that these rules with NIL and then, you know, the additional scholarships for some of these bigger, more wealthy programs that are more well-funded by boosters, et cetera, those players aren't necessarily going to leave.
And I do want to jump in here and just say that, you know, we don't want to spell doom across the land, but, you know, with the limiting roster amount year round to 34 starting next fall, I think that will potentially take some of the burden off of the talent hoarding. I think it's a lot easier to hoard talent when you can have 75 players on campus in the fall competing for your roster. But I mean, the same thing holds true. You know, what we were talking about with LSU earlier is, you know, it's 16 players with college experience coming in to dunk on a very talented freshman class, because they're the ones who are going to play. I mean, they're the ones who have the proven track record. And that's going to become a theme of this podcast as we keep going. But Jeff, you brought up a really good point. Clogging the pipeline by Prager coming back, that pushes a talented weekend starter to midweek, that pushes the midweek guy off of midweek, maybe into a bullpen role, and it pushes everybody back down. Now, I want to talk about Ajax, A-J-A-X, one of the top developmental soccer clubs in the world. I've followed them for a long time. I think their development model is as strong as any in all of sports in the world. They do a really good job of developing talent, and part of their model is to develop talent and then sell the talent so that the next talent coming up has an opportunity to play so that they can then sell that talent. And it's a cycle. And I remember, Jeff, this was a few years back. They got all the way to the Champions League final and they lost. I believe they lost to Barcelona that year. And they had a very talented team. And there was internal discussion of whether they should try and keep that team together for one more year to make a run at the Champions League. And ultimately, they decided not to. They decided to sell the players because they felt that it would be catastrophic to their development pipeline and everything that they believe if they brought those players back for one more year. They had them on a timeline, and these talented players that they got all the way to the pinnacle of the sport, the Champions League final with, and lost, they decided that they needed to sell them so that the next players would have their opportunity and so that they could keep the pipeline healthy and keep players moving up. And if they had brought four, five, six of those guys back for one more year to get another shot at the Champions League the next year, maybe they would have won it. But they would have done damage for years to come to what they've been doing in their development model. So if you're looking at that, that's your example of that's what it looks like when top players don't matriculate to the next level when they're supposed to. I think that's ultimately what this comes down to. It's like Ryan Prager, draft eligible, proved what he needed to prove in college baseball, and over the history of the draft, at that point, you're draft eligible and you proved what you're supposed to prove. You're getting $1 million roughly from the Angels. Like, go play professional baseball, and it's someone else's opportunity to slide into that role. Well, that's not what it is anymore. So now we're talking about an inefficient market, which is the NIL collective, overlapping and competing for players with a very hyper-efficient market, which is MLB clubs. And stop me if you've heard this one before. I'm going to go back to soccer here. I don't know if anybody here remembers the names Cristiano Ronaldo and Neymar, two of the biggest stars in the world of sports in soccer. Well, they took the equivalent of 150 plus million euro per year to go play in Saudi Arabia. Fact of the matter is, Jeff, is PSG and Real Madrid and Barcelona and Manchester United and Manchester City, like, those are real clubs that have talent top to bottom on their roster that cannot afford, it'd be catastrophic to their budget to pay one player 150 million euro. Can you fault Ronaldo and Neymar when they have a lot left in the tank for going to Saudi Arabia and taking that money? No, you can't. But this is an example of, here's an inefficient market, endless supply of money in Saudi Arabia. It's fun money, funny money, fun play money, whatever you want to call it. And they're drawing this talent away from the top levels of world soccer, which would be playing in the Premier League, playing in Serie A, playing in the Champions League.
La Liga. Bundesliga.
League One. Right? Like, this is the same thing on a much smaller scale, which is, okay, we know these NIL collectives are funded by really wealthy alumni that have funny money. And that's what MLB clubs are, you know, that's what the Angels are up against. Like, oh yeah, the money that Ryan Prager is getting paid, that didn't go through like extensive valuation analysis. That was like, how much can we pony up?
Yeah.
This is how much they ponied up. So now, I mean, look, that's Prager. I've heard multiple instances in the past 2 years where a high school player strongly considered going to school instead of signing. In both cases, they signed. They had $500,000+ offers per year from the NIL collective of the school they were committed to. And they, you know, obviously they chose to take, you know, their top five round draft money instead, which I think is the wise thing to do. But I think you're going to see that at some point in the next couple of years, Jeff, where you're going to have, I mean, we're not talking about a Matt McClain situation where, you know, he's going to UCLA because, you know, he thinks, you know, he's worth a couple more dollars, and UCLA is not paying Matt McClain to go there. You were talking about a real situation where, okay, I'm turning down $2.5, $3, $4 million. You're going to see it in the next couple of years. A talented high school player is going to turn down multiple millions of dollars in favor of a better money deal, or what they perceive to be a better money deal from a college. And it's not good. It's not good for the pipeline.
I don't know about you, but I love fall. Fall is a time where the weather just feels perfect from the start of the day to the end. It's a great time for me to get on a bike, take a good long ride where it's nice and crisp, not cold, but crisp. And it's time for new fall traditions, like getting regular hydration and energy from Liquid IV. Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier Plus Energy delivers 100 milligrams of natural caffeine plus 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, so you can accomplish all the things you want and need to do. And they've combined their popular peach flavor with the highly requested blackberry to awaken your senses and keep you coming back for more. Liquid IV makes my workouts more enjoyable. It's really easy to prep. I just take my water bottle, fill it with water, some ice, pour in the Liquid IV, stir it up. It's ready to go. It gives me better hydration than I would if I was just using water. It's something that just makes those bike rides even more enjoyable than they were before. Hydration Multiplier Plus Energy delivers energy comparable to 1 to 2 cups of coffee through about 100 milligrams of naturally occurring caffeine. Experience the deliciousness of one of our best-selling flavors, peach, perfectly paired with the highly requested blackberry. It's an all-in-one formula that provides mind and body energy plus hydration that leaves you feeling focused, alert, and ready to take on anything. Tear, pour, live more. One stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. Powered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink. 8 essential vitamins and nutrients. Always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Start a new fall tradition with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. What she's discovered is that the way that many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that can be wrecking your dog's health. And this is true for even many premium brands. Fortunately, she's found that just by adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformations in their health. She's made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone could do the same thing to see incredible changes to their dog's health. I've got two dogs and I want them to be with me for a very long time. There's a lot of good stuff here that made me think about how most dog foods are made, what to avoid for my dogs, and superfoods that are great for them. If you want to keep your dog healthy and happy, go to badlandsfood.com/baseball and watch Catherine's video right now. Again, that's BADLANDSFOOD.com/baseball.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
Yeah, I think it's just, I think the biggest part of it too is kind of a shock to the system and how much college coaches and programs and just all the, we'll say, peripheral businesses sort of associated with college baseball, whether that be summer leagues, etc. Every year, it seems like there's a new wrench that they have to adjust to. And in the end, is it always benefits the Power Five? And I would even say the top of the Power Five, right? We discussed it this weekend. There's a program in UCLA, and I even think to an extent we could see this kind of happen with Vanderbilt. It feels like they're slipping away a little bit as well, where programs that were the top, you know, the mountain in college baseball 5-6 years ago, every year seemed to be losing players, losing recruits, losing prestige, not winning as many games as they had been, not being as competitive. And these are historic programs that have been, you know, you can knock some of the players that have come out of those schools, but they've been, you know, professional player development factories where you can get a pretty good education as well, whether at Vanderbilt or UCLA. And it's not just the natural deterioration of a program like you kind of saw with USC. Like when I was young, USC was kind of like the premier baseball program. When I was early in high school, we had a commit of left-handed pitcher by the name of Justin Lombardi who committed to Alabama. Alabama at that point was the top baseball program in the country. Those sort of naturally deteriorated based on competition, right? Recruiting, coaching, the performance on the field. Now it's not about that as much. You can have a bad season, a bad recruiting class. Uh-oh, go into the portal.
Bailed out.
5 or 6 guys, and you can bail yourself out. And I think that's the part of the college game that I liked, is it was the long-term team-building strategy of it. And I think it's the kind of thing where you got to give a guy like Tim Corbin credit, where, you know, there might have been a guy like J.J. Bleday who didn't play as a freshman and then sort of breaks out in his draft year and then is a really big part of that program, I believe, winning the national championship in his last year. You don't necessarily see that as much, you know? And I sort of wonder about some of the other players we've seen that maybe would have struggled as freshmen, didn't play as freshmen, that then earned their opportunities, stayed in a program, had a consistent message in their ear, and developed into really good professional players and prospects, that some of that's deteriorating, you know? And I think we're development guys. The show is kind of based around player development and, you know, the first season was just me by myself and then brought you in consecutive seasons since. But it was to kind of explore that and to learn more about it. And a big part of that was learning about the college development environments. And I'm starting to wonder if those are going away. I mean, is there an Ajax in England? Southampton was a big one. That's where Gareth Bale came out of and a lot of other players. Leicester was a team that developed a lot of players that would then go on to other teams. Swansea for a few years, which is a Welsh club that was in the Premier League. Similar. Those teams made their money off of developing good players, knowing they were going to go somewhere else. But I don't know if those schools are necessarily going to exist within the American college baseball environment, because those guys aren't sticking around. And now these schools have opportunities to hook these kids in, these bigger power fives that have money, that have NIL money, and keep those guys on campus so they don't end up, you know, committing to, Chase Dolander, was it Georgia Southern that he was at, right? Was it Georgia Southern? I always get that one confused.
It was either Georgia Southern or Georgia State.
Yeah, it might have been Georgia State.
I think it was Southern. I think you were right.
I think it was Southern. I think I'm right. But when I talked to him at the Futures game, he talked a little bit about that year, getting an opportunity to sort of be the guy, take the ball in bigger games, maybe against lesser competition, that prepared him and developed him, you know, to then go to Tennessee as a sophomore and be the best pitcher in the country pretty much that year. He got overtaken as a junior by Paul Skeens, but we can't really fault Dolander for that.
But I
wonder if that's going to happen anymore.
You look at that with Cam Johnson. Cam Johnson went to Georgia Southern. Maybe Cam Johnson would have had that same opportunity, right? Yeah. And I'm not saying Cam Johnson had polish or anything like that to go start anywhere in Division I baseball. And if Cam Johnson, if you're listening to this, I'm a big advocate, right? But if he is at a Georgia Southern, you're telling me that they don't roll him out there every Wednesday until he does figure it out. Maybe halfway through the season, he earns that spot in the weekend rotation. He's not pitching just 9 innings as a healthy pitcher with that kind of prestige at a Georgia Southern, and it doesn't just have to be Georgia Southern. It can be over 150 other Division I college programs that would have given Cam Johnson Wednesday every week, whether he threw strikes or he didn't throw strikes. They would have done it. Look, I went to Bryant University. You're familiar with the Northeast. Like, you're telling me that a player of that talent isn't going to start every Wednesday anywhere in the Northeast? And there's other parts of the country that are just like the Northeast when it comes to college baseball. You're telling me that if that kid wasn't at Ball State, Kent State, Wright State, Miami of Ohio, that he's not starting every single Wednesday, regardless of whether he's throwing strikes or not? Like, that's development. He needs it. He needs to go out there and he needs to go figure out how to get outs. Well, he didn't do that in 2024. I hope he gets that opportunity at Oklahoma in 2025, Jeff, but I'm not convinced, because Oklahoma went to Omaha last year. 2023, they went to Omaha and they're, you know, they hosted a regional this year. Like, that's another really competitive program. Cam Johnson, if you don't throw strikes at Oklahoma, like, you're not gonna pitch there either. And then you could be in a situation where you're 2 years into your college career and you've got less than 40 competitive innings. And we're gonna get into what that means in terms of potentially getting drafted or paid out of college here in a second. But all of this that we're talking about in terms of NIL collective, inefficient money, MLB draft, and there being more competition and more leverage for players, it sounds like a good thing for players. The one thing that I think I'm going to bring up here is that if you take the money from the college, or you go to college as opposed to going to, if you're an advanced high school player and you go to college and you take the NIL money as opposed to going into Major League Baseball and getting into a farm system and starting your pro career, just understand, and maybe I would ask that the pro community consider some kind of change or find a way to make a change where maybe a player is just always draft eligible after every year. Because what we found with, and I'm going to use Dylan Cruz and Tommy White as an example, they're not the only two examples, but they are two prominent examples. Dylan Cruz was ready for professional baseball after 1 year at LSU. Tommy White was ready for professional baseball after 1 year at LSU. Because they were not draft eligible, they needed to stay, or Tommy White was 1 year after NC State, but then he went to LSU. They needed to stay 2 more years until they were draft eligible again. Okay. That significantly stunted their development, in my opinion. Now, people may argue like, okay, you know, send them straight to double A. You know, Dylan Cruz is moving fast. Wyatt Langford's another example. You could say that all you want, but the reality is that, okay, Dylan Cruz had this thing figured out after his first year at LSU. He hit 362 with a 453 OBP as a freshman. He hit 18 bombs. He walked as much as he struck out. He was ready for professional baseball. Let him get $6 or $7 million at the age of 19 at that point, instead of forcing him to now get tiptoed around for 2 years at LSU, because he's not getting any better, because he's already proven he can play the game at that level and he's not getting promoted. There's no promotion at college baseball. So now you just have to play the game on easy mode for the next 2 years. And that's exactly what he did. Tommy White did the same thing. Tommy White hit 362 at NC State with a 425 OBP, 27 home runs as a freshman. Boom, A+, nailed the level. Okay, now you got to go repeat it for 2 more years. Is that stunting his development? It's absolutely stunting his development. You know what that's doing? That's 2 years of progressing through minor league baseball that he's not going to get back, that Dylan Cruz isn't going to get back. That means that they get to arbitration 2 years later. That means that they potentially get to free agency 2 years later. And that's the big payday. For anybody who's listening, the big payday in baseball is not $800,000 from an NIL collective. It's not $1.2 million on your draft day. It's not arbitration. It's 6 years down the road when you're 28, 29, 30 years old. And yes, the difference of 6 months or a year of your life is going to make the difference between you getting paid 7 years, $250 million, or, he's already 30. He's already kind of starting to trend downhill. Look, like, it's, we're all subject to human physiology. Like, after 28, the body starts to trend in the other direction. Get to free agency when you're 27 or 28, and yep, that's where the big money contracts are. Well, where's the big money going right now, Jeff? The big money is going to the Latin players because they're debuting earlier. They're getting to free agency earlier, and that's ultimately going to be the trend, I think. And the more of these players that are talented that go to college and they get stuck in college, they're pushing back their timelines to get paid, and they're not going to get to that big payday. Now, I will say that is a much higher risk to potentially hold out to get to free agency in the big leagues. It's not easy to get to free agency in the big leagues. But if you are a talented player, if you're a Dylan Cruz or, you know, a Tommy White or a Wyatt Langford or whoever, like, you got to have an out. You got to have an opportunity to go play professional baseball after you ace the level as a freshman.
Yeah, I think going to the NBA sort of model probably makes a lot of sense, right? Of course, you can get drafted out of high school here, which you can't in the NBA any longer, but there are reasons for that. But I think, like, after a single year, you're right. And especially the way that draft models, particularly with college players, are going to look at the production and then factor in age, that the payday for Tommy White was probably after that freshman season at NC State. He goes into the draft and maybe he makes $500,000 to $1 million more as well. And then in the end has an opportunity, as you said, to develop, be challenged. I think for the most part, we can't say this universally, but for the most part, pro development, particularly in the hitting side, is going to be better than a lot of these colleges. And you're going to be able to replicate high level professional at bats in a much easier environment. To do so, whether that's in the actual minor leagues, whether it's in spring training, whether it's, you know, at bats against a rehabbing big leaguer within your own organization, the Traject machine, whatever it might be, these organizations have the ability to challenge these players in an environment where failure isn't as much of a concern necessarily. That's a big part of baseball, is failing. But also, you know, those guys could become better players, get to free agency earlier. And I think that's the big thing, is Dylan Cruz should have been drafted out of high school. He wasn't. He should be able to go to LSU for a year, say, all right, here's my stock. I'm back. Can I get $7 million now? You know, being able to prove it on a 1 year deal, I think is good for a player. I think it's good for team. I think it's good for the game. I think it's even good for some of these schools, because it would, you know, knock down some of the the competition and backup in terms of playing time for a lot of these guys that could keep some of these guys on campus. Now, if you're Jay Johnson, you take over LSU, of course you want Dylan Cruz to stay there because it's much easier to win a national championship when you have, you know, professional players more or less playing for you for consecutive years. But I think that's a concern. I think that's maybe the adjustment that MLB needs to make in terms of allowing these guys to come in and enter the draft at any point in their college careers.
Yeah, I think in, we can use a very specific example here. Paxton Kling was a pretty highly touted name that went to LSU. That if Dylan Cruz had left LSU after his freshman year or after his sophomore year, that paves the way for Paxton Kling to play, talented incoming freshman to play, because now there's an open spot in the outfield. But Dylan Cruz was in his third year at LSU, and Paxton Kling as a freshman got 106 plate appearances, and he hit 289, which was enough for them to say, hey, come back and try again next year. He came back and tried again this past year, 173 plate appearances. He hit 222. He was underwhelming, right? So now he's 21 years old. He was just draft eligible. He's got 279 plate appearances across 2 years as a highly touted high school prospect. This guy almost made, he might have made the 18U national team. If not, he was one of the last cuts, right? And he's now headed out. I don't know where he committed. I think he committed maybe to another Power Four school. But the bottom line is he did 2 years at LSU, and he was, there was somebody else when he wasn't doing well to come in and take his at bats, as there always is. It's the clogging of the pipeline. But Jeff, I want to play a hypothetical here. Every year there are high school players that draft and sign that are what we call advanced high school bats. Okay, so let's look at Kevin McGonigal. I think Max Clark is another good example, and Aiden Miller. Okay, so these are guys that we would say if they went the other way and they went to school as opposed to going to professional baseball, Jeff, how would they have done with their first year of freshman college baseball?
Probably, I would imagine, probably rake, right? You know, every single one of those guys, you kind of look at how they produced in low A. I would think the numbers would probably be pretty substantial, pretty loud, you know?
Right. So you're looking at those three players, and all three of them have been promoted from A ball to high A. So they're all currently in high A. I know McGonigal, and or at least Clark, has taken well to the higher level of competition. I'm not sure I'm McGonigal off the top of my head as of August 2nd, 2024. And I know Aiden Miller is struggling with the higher level, but he aced A ball. And there are three guys that were drafted last year that are now in high A, and per our conversation earlier, they're on pace as they progress through minor league baseball, as they ace the assignment, as you know, whatever it is, to get promoted, get to the big leagues. And then when they get to the big leagues, they can get to arbitration faster, and they can potentially get to free agency faster, right? If they went the Dylan Cruz, Tommy White route, then they end up in a situation where they ace the assignment as a freshman in college. That's what we're assuming those three guys would have done as advanced high school bats, and they would have just been stuck there for 3 years. So that's the point. Not going to beat that horse dead anymore, but how, Jeff, does this dwindle the talent pool? Well, we talked about talent hoarding. We talked about there's only so many opportunities, and I just brought up Paxton Kling and less than 150 plate appearances in 2 years at LSU and draft eligible, and he bounced. MLB draft models, draft rooms, the guys that aren't using the models, whatever you're looking at right now. Well, there's a lot of things. We talked about how cataclysmic the changes were on the college baseball side. Went from 40-round draft in Major League Baseball down to a 20-round draft. We're consolidating the minor leagues, eliminating multiple levels. There are fewer jobs in minor league baseball, which means amateur scouting departments need to be more efficient with who they're bringing into their organization, and they need to be more cognizant of, okay, this is my investment. This guy's going to take a roster spot in A-ball. This guy's going to take a roster spot, you know, in rookie ball. This guy's going to take a roster spot in high A. And what that means, you know, at the draft, there's guys getting cut from minor league baseball because there's only so many spots. I mean, a spot in professional organized baseball right now is that's a golden ticket right now if you have interest in being a professional baseball player. It is really hard to come by. Well, There are things that we know that are not universal, but they're close to it. A lot of amateur scouting departments are analytic driven. If you're not at this point, if it's not part of what you're doing, you're probably a little bit outdated, right? I'm not saying that analytics have to make the decisions, but if you're not factoring in certain things, then you're probably getting beat in the long run at the amateur draft. But there are things that are universal, almost universal truths, and that's draft models do not like 23-year-olds. They do not like old players. They probably don't even like 22-year-olds, to be completely honest with you. Okay? So there's a lot of clubs out there that will not take an old player. Okay? Two, they don't like players that don't have a meaningful sample size. Now, that holds true on the high school side in terms of like high-level showcase events and having TrackMan data from those events and having, you know, at-bats against high-level pitching. That also holds true on the college side. So if you're looking at a player, and I'm going to use the example that I've used a number of times, and I'm sorry, JD, you become the poster child of this. JD Rogers, who's hitting over 300 in Brewster this summer in his first full season of baseball since he was in high school. Good for him. He's already been draft eligible as a high school player, twice as a college player, and now he's heading back to Vanderbilt for his senior year, and hopefully he'll get a full season of at-bats at Vanderbilt for the first time. But he will be old, and he does not have track record. So that makes it really difficult to convince an analytics model that this is a player that we need to draft into our system. And yeah, this is the dwindling of the talent pool, because JD Rogers, Jeff, you saw him in person. I happen to know that he is an outstanding athlete that, you know, is basically a body double to the center fielder for the Atlanta Braves, Jared Kelenic. He needed to go somewhere and play and develop. Jeff, you've seen the physicality. You've seen that he can run. You've seen that there's some thunder in the bat. There's tools there. Mm-hmm. JD Rogers might not get an opportunity to play affiliated baseball even after hitting 300 on the Cape this summer. Just because he doesn't have a track record. He went to Vanderbilt. He didn't play for 3 years. Now he's on the older side, and they need to be efficient with their picks. So it's these types of players. I promise you, and I'll bring up – this is the last time I'll bring up Cam Johnson. He signed a pro contract out of high school. He had 9 innings pitched at LSU. He had 3 innings pitched on the Cape. He's one that, you know, I'm not worried about yet, but – you know, again, if he goes to Oklahoma and he doesn't throw strikes, he's not going to pitch there either. And he's going to be in his third year of college baseball, and he's not going to have a full season worth of track record, which is, Jeff, again, what amateur scouting departments are valuing at the draft in terms of who they pay.
More so than ever, too. You know, I think we look at these drafts now, less high school players are getting taken, less money's getting spent on high school players. And there's a lot of teams where, you know, they put the model on and they just kind of let them auto draft, right? It's like the guy who sets his cue based on his pre-rankings and his fantasy football draft, and they slap that sucker on and just let it go, you know. And there's a few of them. And I was talking to a team yesterday that's model driven, and won't say names. There's another team that somebody who had worked for the other team said their model and your model, the inputs are almost the same. And it's like, so what differentiates us between that team or this other team that all have these very similar models that are maybe based on, say, sort of K to BB, right? With some, you know, exit velocity, power stuff maybe mixed in. And I think what it's showing, and you can go back and look at some of the size of scouting departments and the teams that have drafted well over the last 2 years, the advantage now is those area scouts and those teams that are scouting heavy, that do trust their scouts in the draft room. There's not a ton at this point. They're able to go out and maybe do the detective work and find out a little bit more about some of these other players. And it's how a team like the Mariners ends up with Logan Evans, you know, who wasn't a big star, didn't get turned in by, I mean, I think I've talked to 10 teams now that didn't turn in Logan Evans. It's probably even more if you pulled the whole league. And Logan Evans is now a top 100 prospect. But, you know, without scouting, if you're just looking at a model and you're just looking at a performance model, it can't necessarily identify some of the low-hanging fruit that a player development person and a scout working together on some of these reports can identify. And I think that's some of the stuff that's concerning, because then we end up with very robotic players. We end up with the minor leagues where there's a lot of guys with good approach, decent contacts and power that really can't play a position either. And, you know, you get teams that are drafting 8 first basemen, even if they have different positions listed next to their name in our draft database, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, there's a player that I really liked in this draft, Carter Frederick. I had an opportunity to meet him a couple of years back. He's been through some hardships in life and he's overcome that. And he's focused and he's a hell of a baseball player. But Carter went to Auburn out of high school and he didn't play there. And they kicked back to a place called Snead State, which is not a high, it's not one of your marquee JUCO schools. And he hit almost 500 there. And then he committed to Oklahoma out of Snead State. And this year at Oklahoma, he was off to a pretty good start early on. And then I think he had like a hamate. He had something that knocked him out for the rest of the year. So he's healthy now. He was a 20th round draft pick, Jeff. 6'4", 220 pounds, can run. Really good athlete. He's got some really good tools and he can really hit. But there wasn't much of a sample size there at Oklahoma. Didn't play at Auburn. And, analytic models are not trusting Snead State hitting 500 at Snead State because there really isn't a precedent for that league. So you're sitting here and it's like, okay, well, I'm happy that the Kansas City Royals drafted Carter Frederick in the 20th round because he's going to get an opportunity to play pro ball and he's physically gifted enough and he can hit enough. But he was not checking many boxes when it comes to, is this a guy that we should use one of our 20 picks on for a lot of teams? I would bet that a lot of teams didn't even consider him to be a prospect. So that's to your point, where an area scout could potentially, make some hay is if a club's comfortable in investing in a player that's got a little bit of an unknown, that's not 16 or 17 years old. I don't know. The whole thing is really tricky, but I think the point that we're trying to illustrate here is that there are really talented players out there that for whatever reason, aren't getting their opportunities to build their sample sizes, and 3 years goes fast. And at the end of that 3 years, if you haven't proven something at some level of college baseball, you're not going to be one of the 20 picks for an MLB club. Maybe there's a couple guys out there, but the last thing that I kind of want to say here in regards to this is like, okay, well, if you're a really toolsy player and you need to develop, like Jeff, where do you go? Go to junior college. Look, I'm not knocking junior college. I'm just going to speak a truth here. Jeff, we've talked about this with the exposure funnel. The population of baseball players in this country, generally speaking, and I'm going to be conservative on this, are middle class. A lot of them are upper middle class. Some of them are even upper class. That's your population. It's expensive to play this game at an amateur level.
And if I can interject for a second, I'll say pitchers in particular, upper middle class are wealthy. You see it almost universally. There's not a lot of poor kids coming from the inner city that can pitch. And it's not physically that they can't do it. It's just they're not necessarily getting the money to go to the one-on-one pitching coaching throughout the year, going to the tunnels, being able to work in front of the technology. These coaches that invest in technology, invest in facilities, they got to be able to pay for all that overhead that they have to cover with the technology, updating all those things, blah, 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 blah. They need to charge big money. I'll give you an example. Gary Gilhill, guy that was committed to Farley Dickinson. He's now a top 100 prospect, by the way. Gary Gilhill, a guy that I had heard a lot about in the Northeast, kind of popped late in the process. I believe that after being committed to Farley Dickinson late in the cycle, might have decommitted and then committed to Wake Forest, if I'm not mistaken. Don't quote me on that. I think it was Wake Forest. Ends up getting drafted by the Rays. He's a lot better than a lot of these guys that had more money, trained a little bit more. Frankly, similar areas, Jack Leiter. I think he's probably going to be a better professional pitcher than Jack Leiter is. So far in his career, this was a guy that was a pretty good athlete. There was a lot more to get out of that profile, but didn't come from a ton of money. didn't play as much high level travel ball because, you know, parents probably couldn't afford to get him on the Canes B team and then play his way up to the Canes A team or whatever else it is. Go to these different tournaments, train with these different facilities. A guy like that has to pitch his way into getting those opportunities. And it's just a lot harder, right? Where I think like the financial side of it is a huge implication, particularly on the pitching side. Sorry, that was my aside. Get back to your original point.
Yeah, I think that's another huge rabbit hole that we could potentially go down, and we're not going to do that on this episode, but you're 100% right. But for the area scouts that are listening to this, tell me about those giant fireplaces when you do your in-homes, because that's what a lot of area scouts are. I know it's not every area of the country, but it's most areas of the country. A lot of these in-homes that you're doing, you're going into really nice houses, three-car garages, Mercedes on the driveway. If you know an area scout, hug an area scout today. no, but I think the point is that almost completely lost the plot there, but we're back on. Okay. So paint this picture. You're an upper middle class kid. You live, you know, very comfortably, like your dad drives you to your games in his Mercedes. And now someone's telling you that, okay, like, hey, your only option to go play is you got to go to this cinder block in the middle of nowhere in Texas, or you got to go to this cinder block in the middle of nowhere in some part of the country you've never heard of, to a school you've never heard of. I don't even know where the, you know, Northwest Florida State is. That's what the kid would be saying. I don't even know where College of Central Florida or Chipola. What is a Chipola? You know, I know Chipotle, but the bottom line is that junior college baseball is not for everyone, and it's certainly not for everyone that is used to a very charmed life, which is a lot of baseball players. A lot of baseball players are used to a charmed life. So there, can you fault a kid? And this is another Matt Pierce-ism, so shout out to Matt Pierce. Are we faulting the kid who doesn't want to go the JUCO route? Are we faulting the kid who doesn't, you know, if it's not Division I baseball, then I'm not going to continue to play baseball? Because that's a reality, Jeff. If you grew up in a very comfortable home with a pool in the backyard and you go to a private high school and someone's like, hey, if you want to keep playing, like, you just need more reps. You've got a chance. There's a chance that there's a professional career for you on the other side, but you're going to have to go the JUCO route. Nah, I'm good. I'm going to go to, you know, UNC or Virginia Tech or Virginia or whatever else. I'm going to get a nice four-year education. I'm going to go to the football games. I'm going to go to the basketball games, and I'm just going to go be a kid. I think there's a lot of kids out there that are making that choice as opposed to saying, you know what, I'm going to give this baseball thing a try and I'm going to go live in the cinder block. That's very real. It's very real. So where does the toolsy kid, maybe he's a little bit raw, who needs to develop, go? There's really only one place left, and that's professional baseball. And fewer American high school kids are getting drafted into professional baseball. Jeff, I think Baseball America did an article on that. That the numbers have dwindled every year consistently over the last 10 or 15 years. And it's only going to continue to get worse as MLB clubs are outbid by NIL collectives. I mean, outside of Prager, we also saw Tyler Bell turn down second round money, which was, I think, $1.25 million. And
I had heard that the offer was up to $1.5 million, but don't quote me on that. It might even have been higher.
Slot was $1.25 million.
And he had money, I think, maybe to go to two.
And he's going to Kentucky. Okay. Prager is taking money from A&M instead of taking his $1 million from the Angels. College kid. Chris Lavonis was picked one pick after Tyler Bell. So his slot was around $1.25 million. He's going to Wake Forest. Okay. This is going to become, I think, more common, is top five round high school kids are going to have real decisions to make because they're going to have more leverage because their schools are going to be fighting with cash for their services. Jeff, I mean, we've talked about the exposure funnel. We've talked about how the talent pool has been shrinking on the amateur side. This is going to shrink it at the college level. I think we're going to see the game kind of go the route of, and it's already kind of going in this direction. What we're seeing, this isn't just a baseball problem. It's amateur sports in this country are broken. Who's the next big NBA superstar, American superstar, Jeff? You watch
Cooper Flagg.
Cooper Flagg. Hopefully, because the last couple draft classes haven't been particularly overwhelming. The best players in the NBA, correct me if I'm wrong, you watch the sport more than I do, are Luka Doncic, Nikola Jokic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Victor Wembanyama. International guys, LeBron and Curry are aging out. Zion Williamson and John Morant were kind of like that next American hope, and neither of them have kind of stepped forward. I'm seeing
Jaw's been good when he's healthy and not getting himself in trouble off the court.
Right, but he hasn't. I guess the point is he hasn't taken that step forward, and he's not the face of the Olympics right now.
No,
LeBron James is the face of the Olympics, and the guy's 40 years old.
Simone Biles, she's going to be on the team in a week, I think, too. She's got bounce.
I'm talking about specifically the men's basketball.
I know.
Yeah. But yeah, that's Rudy Gobert's another example. Domantas Sabonis was a top 10 player in the NBA this year, not American born. So we got per the win shares metric on Basketball Reference. I'm not as privy to basketball advanced metrics, but four of the top five players in the NBA per the win shares metric this past year were international.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the NBA looks at that. I mean, it's not that the NBA should look at that or the MLB should look at that as a problem per se, but I think we as Americans should look at that and be like, is our system broken because our talent pipeline isn't keeping up with the rest of the world? And it's not. And we're seeing a similar trend in baseball. I mean, who are the top players in the game? Your MVPs last year. You got Ronald Acuna, Shohei Ohtani. Juan Soto's the top player in the game, right? Like, who are your top American-born players? I mean, is Bobby Witt Jr., you know, one of the last hopes? You got Bobby Witt Jr., Gunnar Henderson, Corbin Carroll. I think Corbin Carroll's going to be just fine. But we're trending in this direction, and you can go look at WAR for position players. And I've got these numbers. In 2014, American-born players ranked 1 through 7 in Fangraphs WAR and occupied 19 of the top 30 spots 10 years later. So this was as of July 25th. American players occupy 3 of the top 7, not 1 through 7, and just 12 of the top 30. So, and this has been a trend. You can go look at all the years in between, and you can see that it's trending in that direction. There are more international players, especially on the position side, that are top 30 in WAR in Major League Baseball. And everything that we just discussed for the past hour, if you're still with us, thanks for still being with us. I'm going to throw you a cookie here in a second. Everything that we just discussed is impacting the American pipeline of talent to professional baseball. And, you know, this has been happening over years, and this is just going to continue to accelerate it. Now there's competition from college sports, college NIL collectives for the same levels of talent. They're going to start pulling them away. Look, it's not going to be like there's never going to be another high school draft player, you know, draft pick ever again, but like we can't. Jeff, my closing argument. I don't want to live in a world where Dylan Cruz and Tommy White and a whole bunch of really talented high school players get stuck in college baseball for 3 years.
Yeah.
Because it's going to kill the American superstar. And as someone who has some pride for American baseball, that's not what I want to see. The cookie that I want to throw here, and then Jeff, I'll throw it over to you for closing thoughts. Favorite player in the, I've got a favorite high school draft 2025 MLB draft prospect, high school player, favorite one. So if you're listening to this and if you hung around for an hour and 12 minutes,
Brock, your payoff for your Open Universe League, go get him.
Brock Kettleson. That's my favorite player in the class.
Why is that?
6'4", 200 pounds, left-handed bat, also left-handed on the mound, plays catch at 90 to 92. Probably your best combination of size and athleticism for the 2025 high school class. Stanford commit. It's going to be at area codes next week. I don't know if this will come out before area code games.
But just let it be known. Let it be known before the rest of the world is introduced to Brock Ketelson that's my guy. I'm not saying he's going to be the top player off the board next year, but I like him as a first rounder. Jeff, we've gone long, and we also forgot to take your pause.
It's all right. We'll get a commercial break in there at some point. We see the conversation always rolls, and we forget. But it's been another episode of the 90th Percentile. I hope that you learned quite a bit. I know that I learned quite a bit today, just sort of talking through some of this stuff and the dynamics of college scholarships and where things are going and all the rule changes that we've seen. Sort of two roster billing, I'll say, just kind of throw it under that umbrella over the last 3 to 4 years post-pandemic. It's a brave new world in college baseball. And thanks for Matt for breaking it down for us. Once again, this is the 90th Percentile. Thanks for tuning in.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.